Right, testing again. It's Jason Horsley for The Liminalist Between the Podcast. Again, this is part two of my dialogue with the late Simone Weil, specifically her work Gravity and Grace. So, yes, I left off after the chapter on evil. Ends on page 79. I wanted to say something briefly about my impressions of Simone Weil based on just this one work. There's two things. One is that I know I have a tendency to gravitate to overly ascetic, overly taxing, overly pessimistic, perhaps even spiritual philosophy, as I did with John DeRuyter. Austerity has its appeal to me. Saturn, 8th house. The other thing that's related, which is that Simone Weil may or may not have been somebody who suffered from depression. I don't actually know about her background. I would say that I am somebody who suffered from depression for my whole life, even though I don't think that depression is particularly helpful as a term. Unhappiness was just as good a word, or a better word perhaps. Despair, certainly. But anyway, I bring it up because there's a possibility that her wisdom, such as it is informed by a personal temperament that she had, and that perhaps some of her wisdom is not wisdom but a kind of spiritualized rationalization for a gloomy mindset. That's not actually my impression, it's just that I know that it's possible that I have that tendency myself to gravitate towards, as I say, austere, rather stark spiritual perspectives that relate a lot to the negation of the self or the value of the self, and therefore I have to acknowledge that this might be informing my interest and my attachment to these writings. So that's kind of a disclaimer, just an acknowledgement, if you will, of what may be an underlayer or subtext of some of these passages that qualifies it. This is not truth, capital T, but it is one person's perspective that I consider to be unusually profound and unusually helpful or impactful at this time in my life. It does seem to correspond with a growing acceptance in my life. Okay, so this is page 83, this is the chapter on affliction. By nature we fly from suffering and seek pleasure. It is for this reason alone that joy serves as an image for good and pain for evil. Hence the imaginary paradise, hence the imagery of paradise and hell. But as a matter of fact, pleasure and pain are inseparable companions. And if we conceive the fullness of joy, suffering is still to joy what hunger is to food. I'll read the surrounding passage there, because nothing's coming to mind to respond. To say that the world is not worth anything, that this life is of no value, and to give evil as the proof is absurd. For if these things are worthless, what does evil take from us? This is similar with the statement that life is meaningless. Is of course a meaningless expression, because life encompasses everything and all expressions within it. So if we say that life is meaningless, we're not saying anything. Now, if we say that life is meaningful, we are stating something that is obvious. You could say it's a tautology, but nonetheless, well, at least it's meaningful. Can tautologies be meaningful? Why not? Water is wet, still meaningful. Might not be very information rich, but it's an acknowledgement of a base reality. Thus, the better we are able to conceive of the fullness of joy, the purer and more intense will be our suffering in affliction and our compassion for others. Thus, the better we are able to conceive of the fullness of joy, the purer and more intense will be our suffering in affliction and our compassion for others. What does suffering take from him who is without joy? And if we conceive the fullness of joy, suffering is still to joy what hunger is to food. This is something I've referred to on and off and referring back to a turning point in my life when I was 20, that the absence signals a presence, that the absence of meaning in my life signals the possibility of meaning to be sought. I can say that my life is meaningless, but I can't say that life per se is meaningless, because otherwise, compared to what? If I feel that my life or any given action or thought or statement that I make is meaningless, it's in the context of a meaning that it's falling short of or contradicting. Lack of coherence. And I want to use that word coherence more, and incoherent in the coming days of increased liminality and polarization, because I think it's a very strong concept, coherence and incoherence. It's less sort of value laden than meaning and meaninglessness, and certainly it's less charged than sane or insane or true or false or true or delusion. I'm thinking in terms of the trans thing that I'll be writing about soon, that my tendency is to constantly refer to that or other statements or positions that people take as insane, because they seem manifestly so to me. But I realize that that's not really helpful. That's a dogmatic position, to use charged words like that. And of course, it's notoriously subjective, sane and insane. But coherent and incoherent, I think, is... Anyway, that was a digression that suffering is part of our attempt to realign ourselves to joy and to meaning and to truth. As in, not that we suffer and we know we should act on it, but the suffering because we're doing something wrong, because that doesn't help. That's a terrible Chinese finger trap to be caught in, I know, because I have been in it for so long. But that when we suffer, something is potentially happening that is realigning ourselves. The suffering itself is the body's and the soul's attempt to realign themselves to one another, and it's the mind that can either get involved in that and perpetuate or add unnecessary suffering to the necessary, and therefore actually prevent the purpose of suffering from being fulfilled, or one can not let the mind get involved except insofar as acknowledging this, that something is attempting to find balance in ourselves, and therefore suffering is not a cause for regret any time. It's actually an absence that is being filled by the mere non-act of experiencing it. So in that sense, the analogy of food and hunger isn't quite right, because we don't need to do anything to quench the spiritual hunger. We simply need to experience it and put our attention on it. Right, I guess that's like a child who, like the perfect childhood, infancy would be where the infant's hunger is met without actually having to cry out for it. This is from The Cross, page 91. In emptying ourselves, we expose ourselves to all the pressure of the surrounding universe. So the more clear and uncluttered we become internally, the more vulnerable and the more sensitized. Enlightenment isn't a raising up above our travails and our concerns, it's an expanding into them, the opposite of a contraction from them. So, but it's not kicking against the pricks either, it's not pushing against the problems. So it's not as though the thorns actually go deeper, but that we experience the pain of them that much more acutely. This is an interesting line. Well, I'll read the whole passage. One, the smallest of the numbers, the one that alone is wise, that is the infinite, a number which increases, thinks that it is getting near to infinity, it is receding from it. We must stoop in order to rise. If one is God, infinity is the devil. Well, I wish I'd had that quote for Prisoner of Infinity. I think of any single line, or really the series of that passage, it needs the, all the lines really to be coherent, or to sum up the Prisoner of Infinity thesis at a deeper level, then that would be a good one, I think. The will to power that wants to expand our consciousness at the price of fragmenting it, that we think if we keep fragmenting more and more and multiplying our perceptions and our perspectives, we're actually expanding into the infinite. We are expanding into the endless, because there's no end to the fragmentation. Well, it seems like there isn't. Maybe there would be annihilation, God forbid, but that wouldn't be an end that we would experience. There's no completion to it. It's never completed. No rest for the wicked. I feel weird because I'm aware of the camera and yeah, I'm doing a podcast, but the camera's sort of pulling me slightly out of my focus, even though I don't necessarily plan to use the video. So I feel about being spread too thin. Made me think of Videodrome for some reason, because I was listening to David Cronenberg commentary on Videodrome. And seeing as I mentioned that, if any of you listeners or viewers collect DVDs still, and you have DVDs with commentaries on, let me know, because I'm not collecting, but I'm listening to commentaries, because I'm finding them just an enjoyable thing to listen to, because I don't listen to podcasts. So, there's certain hard to find, they're all generally very hard to find online, commentaries of, you know, from the classics and the more interesting movies. Okay, that was a complete digression. Impossibility is the door of the supernatural. We can but knock at it. It is someone else who opens. Yes, well, knock and it shall be opened, ask and you shall receive. I mean, that's the nutshell, the sort of conundrum of salvation, in the Christian sense, that on the one hand, there's nothing we can do to ensure that we attain truth, and yet, if we don't do what's necessary, then we won't. If we don't knock, it can't be opened. But knocking doesn't guarantee that it will be opened. Well, knock and it shall be opened, but how do we knock, I suppose? Like, we can think that we're knocking, and we're not. We'll be pounding on the doors with our skulls, and it's not gentle enough. It's not. We're not knocking with the part of us that is hurt. And I guess that would be simply that the part that's knocking, demanding to be opened to, isn't heard. It's the part that knocks with no assumption of being received. which is, I suppose, the impossible and the supernatural. And this is one of the pitfalls, maybe the pitfall of Strieber and Kripe on the supernatural and all that stuff, and even, I'd say, Jordan Peterson with his Bible stories for dummies, and even someone like Jung, perhaps, all of them, really, that they make the supernatural, and of course religion too, seem comprehensible to us. If we don't, well, I was going to say, if we don't look close enough, I'd say in terms of religion, we can look at scripture, if we look at it close enough, we'll see that it's not comprehensible, it just appears it. And whereas these secondary or tertiary commentators, they really are attempting to provide coherence or impose their own coherence. And it feeds or it strengthens, reinforces that part of us that thinks that we can relate to the supernatural in the same way that we relate to the natural. As in, we can use energy and will to get a response, to get results, and we can't. That's the nature of it. If we could, it would have been destroyed already by us. If it was really susceptible to our wills in any way, we would have willed it into non-existence, into slavery. I suppose to some degree we've done that. I mean, we've created images of the divine in order to control them. To do good. Whatever I do, I know perfectly clearly that it is not good. For he who is not good cannot do good. And God alone is good. On every occasion, whatever we do evil and an intolerable evil. This is what I mean by being a bit bleak and austere. We must ask that all the evil we do may fall solely and directly on ourselves. That is the cross. So that would be the only good, essentially, is that we act with our attention on the good of others, let's say, and the goodness of God even, though that's a dangerous concept in itself, of course, the most dangerous, but also, at the same time, divided in a healthy way or balanced, with the attention on our own evil, our own propensity for evil, so that we are always reminded that, again, you know, any action that is, well, unfortunately, this is in Crowley, driven by the lust for result. Well, of course, there is truth in disinformation always, a lot of it, that's focused on the results of our actions in this sequential linear fashion, it always becomes compromised. It's because I think we can only act, I mean, the only pure action is a response, and a response motivated to discover, like we want to discover more about the truth of ourselves in relation to the other. And so we might try to do good for the other, but that's more about, and I'd say this is experiential for me, minimizing the evil that we're doing without just withdrawing, because it's not enough just to not engage with people in order to minimize the evil we do unto them, because then we're ignoring them, we're shutting them out, and that's also a disservice. So it's like having the courage to engage with people knowing that we're going to get it wrong, and doing it in that spirit of just it's curiosity, but it's more than that. It's a soul curiosity, longing to discover the truth through interaction with other human beings. I'd say that that's a reasonable motivation, and primarily the truth is about my own good and evil, you know, how intertwined they are, and how much I'm effectively disentangling them and allowing something good to come through. This is the chapter Contradiction from page 98. The contradictions the mind comes up against, These are the only realities. They are the criterion of the real. There is no contradiction in what is imaginary. Contradiction is the test of necessity. Contradiction experienced to the very depth of the being tears us heart and soul. It is the cross. Well, there's a fundamental contradiction in being here, which is that we are temporal beings nested in eternity, and that is inherently contradictory, because what is like if you were to divide any number by infinity, you have zero. If you were to try and put a lifetime of 80 years into eternity, it vanishes. It's infinitely vanishing. There's no context in which we can exist, because the only context is eternity. There's no context in which time can exist, because time, doesn't matter how long it goes on, it's nothing compared to eternity. So there's an inherent contradiction in existence. It's, you know, non-existence somehow experiences existence. It's if you haven't found yourself staring at that conundrum, then I'd say you haven't really put your attention on existing, because it's right at the center of us, me anyway. There's a contradiction, so we're always pinned on that cross, at least until we surrender to non-existence, and then I guess maybe there's no contradiction anymore, because we, well, dot dot dot. There's no contradiction in what is imaginary. So this is the crucial fiction, the appeal of imaginary spiritual, political, ideological narratives and beliefs about ourselves and about the world, that we're looking for an experience that isn't contradictory, that doesn't, you know, intensify that innate awareness of being on the cross, of being split down the middle by the contradictory nature of existence. And so we dissociate. It's like we perpetuate the split so much that we leave half of us behind, and so then we're just in one half, and then it's not, there's no contradiction there, and it's imaginary. It's also imaginary. We can generate then narratives made out of beliefs, mixture of belief and perceptions and temporal sensory perceptions, and dictate it in such a way just as if we were writing fiction. Because when you write fiction, if you ever have, that's the goal: make it coherent, make it non-contradictory, so that it all follows on and it makes sense and it adds up, and then it's successful. So I suppose when I said that coherence is the measure, it's actually a deeper thing than coherence, because it's coherence that allows for contradiction. A coherence that is contradictory but not incoherent. It's the difference between a paradox, two truths mirroring each other, opposites, and a contradiction, which is just two factual statements which don't add up. So it's the level at which we're measuring or narratizing the perceptions. And this is something I'm always encountering, which is that in discussions with people, that we have this unconscious tendency to shift levels, is what I saw in John DeRuta too, that if we can't reconcile a contradiction, we're not willing to really go all the way into it and let go of, let's say, a factual contradiction, we're not willing to let go of our beliefs in order to meet the facts or let the facts change our beliefs, then we go up a level at which the contradiction is a paradox, and then, oh, well, that's okay then. So it's like the gender thing, a high or a deep spiritual level, we're male and female in one, biological sex doesn't define us, and so on and so forth. So then we're going to drag that down to the body level so it meets our ego ideology, then we've created incoherence that banishes contradiction, as opposed to did I say created incoherence? We created a false coherence that banishes contradiction and therefore is inherently incoherent. Contradiction. Method of investigation. As soon as we have thought something, try to see in what way the contrary is true. Evil is the shadow of good. All real good, possessing solidity and thickness, projects evil. Only imaginary good does not project it. Right. As all good is attached to evil, if we desire the good and do not wish to spread the corresponding evil round us, we are obliged, since we cannot avoid this evil, to concentrate it on ourselves. Bodhisattva stuff. Thus the desire for utterly pure good involves the acceptance of the last degree of affliction for ourselves, Christ on the cross. We can't identify the good without thereby inviting all measure of unjust affliction upon ourselves, because the innocent suffers most of all in this world. That's the nature of this world. That's the contradiction inherent in this world, that a world created by an all-good creator is overrun by evil and not safe for innocence. And yet it's the innocence that redeems the evil, redeems the world by submitting to that contradiction reality. If we desire nothing but good, we are opposing the law which links real good to evil, as the object in the light is linked to its shadow. And being opposed to one of the world's universal laws, it is inevitable that we should fall into affliction. The mystery of the cross of Christ lies in a contradiction, for it is both a free will offering and a punishment which he endured in spite of himself. If we only saw in it an offering, we might wish for a like fate. But we are unable to wish for a punishment endured in spite of ourselves. There's something that we can experience, or we do experience on a daily basis, that we can there can be an opportunity there, which is the feeling of being misunderstood or unjustly judged, and the corresponding desire, the need to stand up for ourselves. Like, that's a daily and almost an hourly experience, I'd say. It relates to boundaries and how we draw them, you know, whether we're drawing them in a compassionate way as an acknowledgement of a necessary limitation, or whether we're drawing boundaries in a reactive way and in a revengeful way, essentially. When we're hurt, we want to hurt back. And because even protecting ourselves, or at least defending ourselves, has an element of that, as when we withdraw emotionally from a friend or a partner who's hurt us, we can tell ourselves we're just trying to protect ourselves from further harm, but we're also trying to hurt the other person, to communicate them that we've been hurt by hurting them in turn, at least making them feel bad. And that's so natural that it seems healthy. And at a biological or physical level, it is healthy. But that's the difference between a spiritual path truly called and a natural path, or a purely instinctive path about survival. A spiritual path does entail negating the self. And the biological self, ironically, is what trans is all about. But of course, not in a way to get what one wants. The opposite, it's negating that desire, that need, that imperative to get what we want, and just surrendering to a higher reality that already is and always will be, and that doesn't depend on us experiencing it to exist. Therefore, our desire is cancelled by that, because if our desire is for the goodness of existence, and even to represent the goodness of existence, we don't have to experience it for that, because we already represent it, because everything represents God, whether it knows it or likes it or not. So yes, it's not self-negation that reinforces the self, needless to say. It's the self-negation that approximates or aligns with the reality that the self doesn't exist in the way that we've conceived it. So it's more of an acknowledgement of something that already is. Here we are, the distance between the necessary and the good. Every attempt to justify evil by anything other than the fact that that which is an offence against this truth. In other words, no end justifies the means arguments. Whatever we perceive to be evil, we can't judge it. Well, that's a tough one to swallow, isn't it? But nor can we justify it save via an acknowledgement of good and evil existing within a context that transcends both, and that we don't have direct knowledge of. So there's good and evil on our level, and we can discern between the two to some degree, but the good that is distinguishable from evil to us is not the true good. Because it's not the good that transcends evil, it's the good that opposes evil. And that's necessary and good, but it's not the level that provides coherence to evil or suffering in the world. As in, it's not a good argument to do evil to bring good about. We know that. That's a very bad argument. That's a cause of a great deal of unnecessary evil, I'd say. And it requires a corresponding doing of good to bring about evil, which is really messed up. So here's the passage I put a question mark next to because I didn't understand it, and I'm going to read it anyway because I don't want to just pass over the passages that I don't necessarily agree with. There aren't many. Evil can only be purified by God or by the social beast. Purity purifies evil, so does force in quite another way. In the case of one who is able to do all things are permitted. He who serves an all-powerful master can do all things through him. Force delivers us from the good-evil cycle, delivers him who exercises it, and even him also who submits to it. A master has every license, so has a slave. The sword affords deliverance, whether through its handle or its point, from the intolerable weight of our obligation. Grace also delivers us from the burden, but we only go towards it through obligation. We only escape limitation by rising up towards unity or going down towards the limitless. So it was mainly the thing that force delivers us from the good-evil cycle. I don't understand that, and so I don't agree with that. Because you can't agree with something you don't understand. Can you disagree with something you don't understand? Probably not. Those who have the privilege of mystical contemplation, having experienced the mercy of God, suppose that, God being mercy, the created world is a work of mercy. But as for obtaining evidence of this mercy directly from nature, it would be necessary to become blind, deaf, and without pity in order to believe such a thing possible. Thus the Jews and Muslims who want to find in nature the proofs of divine mercy are pitiless, and often the Christians are as well. Very interesting thesis paragraph there. God is weak because he is impartial. Underline that line. Of course God can't by definition be weak, because God is the power that's behind everything, and yet in this world God is weak because he is impartial to suffering, good and evil. Therefore he doesn't act to rectify it. He's effectively powerless, it seems, as though that's what she's saying. I'm not saying this, I don't know. But I do think there's something in it, like the Tao Te Ching writes about, that the weak force is the most powerful. The force that we perceive as the weakest, because we have a topsy-turvy criteria for understanding and perceiving reality and existence, that's the most powerful. The one that seems non-existent even. And that so far as we do perceive its existence, it just seems... I wonder if this is, well, this is what she just said, isn't it? Well, like why Jehovah was kind of an overcompensating God, wrathful, vengeful, certainly proactive, but also reactive God, who's constantly getting involved. And well, of course, as the Bible proceeds, the Old and New Testament becomes less and less. The presence of Yahweh is less and less observable. Of course, at a certain point, Christ the Incarnation, and then God is observable literally as a man, but that also goes hand in hand with a further withdrawal of God as a deity that's acting on history. Communion is good for the good and bad for the wicked. Hence damned souls are in paradise, but for them paradise is hell. I can believe that. Atheism is purification. There are two atheisms, of which one is a purification of the notion of God. That's self-explanatory, isn't it? Of two men who have no experience of God, he who denies him is perhaps nearer to him than the other. My brother was a denier of God, and I'd say he was nearer to God than many people, or perhaps even most people who affirm God. certainly got crucified. I don't know if I'd say it was nearer to God than I am, because we can't measure. We shouldn't really compare between any people's closeness to God, because it's a zero distance / infinite distance. So, compared to what? You know, you're either with God or you're not in that framework. But also because we can't gauge our own proximity to God. If we could, once again, then we would have control, or think we have control over the process. Attention and will. We have to try to cure our faults by attention and not by will. Key passage. The will only controls a few movements of a few muscles, and these movements are associated with the idea of the change of position of nearby objects. I can will to put my hand flat on the table. If inner purity, inspiration, or truth of thought were necessarily associated with attitudes of this kind, they might be the object of will, and this is not the case. We can only beg for them. To beg for them is to believe that we have a Father in heaven, or should we cease to desire them? What could be worse? Inner supplication is the only reasonable way, for it avoids stiffening muscles which have nothing to do with matter. What could be more stupid than to tighten up our muscles and set our jaws about virtue or poetry or the solution of a problem? Attention is something quite different. Pride is a tightening up of this kind. There is a lack of grace. We can give the word its double meaning here, in the proud man. It is the result of a mistake. Well, she does contradict this later on, because she writes also about something about having the right attitude and putting the attention or thoughts, directing the thoughts in the right way, or something along those lines. And it could be argued that this is, if that doesn't require will, then what does it require? But nonetheless, there's certainly, I think, an argument to be made or explored, that we once again conflate the levels, and we have this unconscious tendency to apply the physical will, as in the will that we use for physical engagement with nature and society, to spiritual matters. Pun unintended. And it simply doesn't work, and not only doesn't work, it's counterproductive, because when we're exercising that kind of will, we're not in a state to receive grace. Our attention is in fact not sufficiently unfocused or open to be receptive. We're in the hammer seeing everything as a nail mode phase. It's making me think of Peterson again, because I don't think he's addressed this contradiction between his model about perception as a tool, or being structured according to tools and obstacles as the basis for our existence, and his attempt to apply that to spiritual reality. I think he is simply applying that to spirituality, so that we just need to set our perception in such a way that we perceive the right spiritual tools and the right spiritual obstacles to advance spiritually. He used spiritual too many times in that sentence, but I think I already basically stated it clearly enough, and I think that is my main track with Peterson. It's the conflation of levels again. So, just relax. All you have to do is relax. Now, and so the attention can open, expand the senses, and like water, that if unimpeded will start to just naturally go where the formations allow it to go, the energy of the soul and of attention will distribute itself through the body over time until we are embodied and ensouled and enlightened and incarnated. The incarnation can occur. And all we did was relax. But there are, of course, things that we can do that prevent us from relaxing. Most of all, try to achieve the thing that we can only achieve through relaxing. And because there are things that we can do that prevent us from relaxing, it follows that there are things that we can do that will facilitate relaxation. Even if it's not doing a lot of those other things, that still is a doing, an undoing. Because we're always doing, we can't stop doing, even if we're just breathing and contemplating, we're still doing. It is only effort without desire, not attached to an object, which infallibly contains a reward. It's rather Crowleyan too, but still true. Perhaps in this way some efforts are always accompanied by the false negation of our inner wretchedness. With others, the attention is continually concentrated on the distance there is between what we are and what we love. Distance between what we are and what we love, as opposed to constantly trying to do things to negate that feeling of the distance within us, which corresponds with our sense of being inner wretchedness, being innerly wretched, and well, again, it's the absence of we're feeling, because insofar as we're aware of our inner lack, our wretchedness, we can try and fix it, compensate for it, seek validation, or we can recognize that that feeling corresponds with our distance, the distance between us and what we love, and so move closer towards what we love. Just by putting our attention on the distance, it moves closer to us, because it also loves us. Like we are the love with which we love God, and God is the love with which we are loved. So the distance is the only thing that's not love, really, is that awareness of distance. It's just a space waiting to be filled. We liberate energy in ourselves, but it constantly reattaches itself. How are we to liberate it entirely? We have to desire that it should be done in us, to desire it truly, simply to desire it, not to try to accomplish it. In many ways, the hardest thing there is. I have to say, marriage has been a great training ground for this. And any of you who've been married or in a long-term relationship, I think, will know exactly what I mean by that. The capacity to drive a thought away once and for all is the gateway to eternity, the infinite in an instant. So that was the example of what I felt that seemed contradictory, because to drive a thought away would appear to require will. So I have to leave that with a question mark, because I think the recognition that a thought is absurd or that leads to error is enough for something in it to push it away, something in us to push it away, or to go around it like water that recognizes an obstacle. As soon as we have a point of eternity in the soul, we have nothing more to do but to take care of it, for it will grow of itself like a seed. It is necessary to surround it with an armed guard, waiting in stillness, and to nourish it with the contemplation of numbers of fixed and exact relationships. That last bit's more obscure, I won't try and unpack that, but certainly point of eternity in the soul is something that I would say that it is possible to be aware of. And it's back to that intersection on the cross, that recognition of being at the center point of a contradiction, the temporal eternity, the temporal face of eternity, the active side of infinity even. We can only know one thing about God, that he is what we are not. Our wretchedness alone is an image of this. The more we contemplate it, the more we contemplate him. Yeah, it's a pill to swallow. Here's another questionable passage. On the other hand, as we have also a principle of violence in us, that is to say, the will, we must also, in a limited measure, but to the full extent of that measure, use this violent principle in a violent way. We must compel ourselves by violence to act as though we had not a certain desire or aversion, without trying to persuade our sensibility, compelling it to obey. This causes it to revolt, and we have to endure this revolt passively, taste of it, savour it, accept it as something outside ourselves, as the pink colour of the room with the red violence. Each time that we do violence to ourselves in this spirit, we make an advance, slight or great, but real, in the work of training the animal within us. So, I do think that that's a dangerous philosophy or methodology. I think that it possibly could be interpreted or unpacked in a way that was sound. I'm not necessarily going to try to do that because I just want to get through this, the rest of the passages, and people are interested, they can comment, I can talk about it again on another occasion. But I will say that she seems to be making a distinction or a point that the advancement isn't the result of doing the violence directly, of doing violence against some part of ourselves, but of provoking a part of ourselves that revolts against the violence, and so observing that part. So it's as if we're training ourselves in reactivity. And this is, it's as though we're becoming an agent of the world, or rather directing that part of us that is already co-opted by the world, the satanic part, which is the lower will, the base will, and allow there is a higher will, that's God's will, we're directing it against ourselves. So this is, I think it's similar to what you said about how we, when we act, we must recognize that there will be a corresponding evil that results if we act goodly, and we must direct that evil towards ourselves. Because that's the nature of the world, that no good deed goes unpunished, and it's possible that others will suffer for our good deeds if we're not taking full responsibility for the mixture of pure and impure in all of our actions, and owning the consequences of the impurity by inviting affliction, unjust punishment from the world, or even directing it against ourselves, I mean punishing ourselves in a conscious fashion for our innocence, because there's a part of us that does that anyway, the guardian, it constantly re-traumatizing ourselves when we're vulnerable, when we're open, when we're becoming awakened, when we're aligning with the divine. The satanic element redoubles its efforts. That's happening anyway. So to become conscious of our alignment with it, I think is the distinction I would make here, as opposed to what she's... It makes it sound like we're actually in charge of that, but I would say that we're not, because it's happening anyway. And that we can redirect that energy by making it more conscious, so it becomes more and more aligned with the world at large, and thereby with, as opposed to our own, you know, worldly trauma, and thereby with God, because God created the world and Christ came into the world to redeem the world, and so on. So the world, although it's under the dominion of Satan, is not separate from God. It's not possible for it to be separate. just to have the appearance of separation. I'm feeling struggle in myself as I talk about this. And this is something I check the time, because I feel like I'm sort of using a bit too much will to move through this, because I feel like I'm running out of time, which of course I'm not, but I do want to keep it to an hour. I've experienced this recently. I won't go into the whole backstory, but there's a struggle in me between the part that curses life and even God, unconsciously, the way that I curse, as in fuck God, fucking Jesus, fuck you, Jesus. There are expressions that have just become habitual to me, which aren't, I don't actually say fuck you, Jesus, I go fuck you, and then I go Jesus, or Jesus, fuck you. So they're separate, but they're not, I can hear myself saying them. So it's very, it's low level Linda Blair stuff. I would say that's the adversary of the satanic intelligence possessing me whenever I'm angry, because that means I'm vulnerable to it. And that's in stark contrast to if I have a prayerful attitude and I'm giving thanks or praying for help in whatever the problem is, because I'm talking about a situation where I'm getting angry and battling with the world, even if it's very mundane, block toilet kind of worldly battle, then rather than be angry, then I can pray for help, and then my attention is on the divine aspect rather than on the problem, and what transcends the problem. And although I don't necessarily go into I don't necessarily experience God moving through me, or I don't necessarily manifest a miracle, at the very least I've been seeing the very clear contrast that the opposition between these two modes of being, and that my default setting is anger and cursing life when afflicted by the world. And so that's that relates to this passage anyway, I think, in terms of redirecting a violence that's already innate in us to actually tame and train the part of us that fuels the violence, the traumatized infant, by conditioning it so that it becomes less reactive to affliction, obstacles, less angry. Intelligence and grace. We know by means of our intelligence that what the intelligence does not comprehend is more real than what it does comprehend. That's a very coherent sentence. That's funny, because one of the reasons I wanted to do this now is because I wanted to find passages for the seedling, and I've forgotten that, but that one I would like to put in the seedling. I'll read it again. We know by means of our intelligence that what the intelligence does not comprehend is more real than what it does comprehend. So in other words, the more intelligent we are, the more we recognize the limits of our intelligence. Which is also similar to the truism that the more we know, the more we realize how little we know. Thank you. privileged role of the intelligence in real love comes from the fact that it is inherent in the nature of intelligence to become obliterated through the very fact that it is exercised. I can make efforts to discover truths, but when I have them before me, they exist and I do not count. The seeker of truth, he will never find it, but in probability of improbabilities, he may say someday become it. Charles Fort, more or less. There is nothing nearer to true humility than the intelligence. It is impossible to be proud of our intelligence at the moment when we are really exercising it. Which is, I guess, is why the Lucifer principle pertains to pride in the creations of the intellect. The world is a text with several meanings, and we pass from one meaning to another by a process of work. It must be work in which the body constantly bears a part. Well, I guess I can vouch for that now. Being the world, recognizing the world as a text, a holy writ, a body of organic knowledge, and thereby moving through the levels, I won't say up, but I guess it is an upward movement, through the levels of meaning to ever deeper, more simple, more pure meanings, that are redemptive. Like, there's many problems, but there's only one solution. There's many sins, many sinners, many demons, but there's only one Messiah, there's only one Savior, there's only one act. And on a day-to-day basis, this is a case that the more in tune we are with what is true in ourselves, the more we're able to deal with the multiplicity of problems by reading them. Because we're relating to the world in a different way. Like I said earlier, it's a curious, compassionate response driven by a deep soul need to discover, uncover more of the truth of ourselves in each moment. Not to use it, though, not to use the truth, just to discover it. The uncomprehended hides the incomprehensible and should on this account be eliminated. So this is back to the more we know, the less we know. As in, the more we begin to comprehend the things we haven't comprehended previously, the closer we get to the incomprehensible. So all of those knowledge, all that knowledge gathered is actually a means simply to remove false knowledge, to eradicate false knowledge. It doesn't have value in and of itself, except that it removes the false knowledge, straightens it out, cancels it out, and gets us closer and closer to the incomprehensible truth, knowledge of God. Or lets it come closer to us, I should say. There's no way that we would make steps towards that. We can be driven by a desire for knowledge that feels sane and healthy and enjoyable and meaningful, but you can't be driven by a desire for an encounter with the incomprehensible. How could you? If you can't comprehend it, it's going to be terrifying. We read, but also we are read by others. Interferences in these readings. Forcing someone to read himself as we read him, slavery. Forcing others to read us as we read ourselves, conquest. A mechanical process, more often than not, a dialogue between deaf people. A dialogue between deaf people. We hate the people who try to make us form the connections we do not want to form. That's a good aphorism. And I feel as though I'm encountering that in part of my work and writing and around ideological narratives and stuff. And of course, conspiracy research is about connections, but I don't think that's as threatening to people as pointing out the contradictions between their beliefs by connecting beliefs that they've compartmentalized. May all suffering make the universe enter into the body. Well, there's a fortune cookie axiom to live by. He who has not been able to become nothing runs the risk of reaching a moment when everything other than himself ceases to exist. It's a sobering thought. Not to accept an event in the world is to wish that the world did not exist. It's like, you don't want mosquitoes? Okay, prepare to watch the whole ecosystem collapse. The whole cow gives milk through the milk, although the milk is only drawn from the udder. In the same way, the world is the producer of saintliness. That's a great one, too. Evil is the form which God's mercy takes in this world. Because if we didn't have the corrective of unearned or undeserved suffering and affliction, then we would never recognize how much we've strayed from reality. It's like body symptoms. Of course they seem evil, but without them the body would stricken and die, which it does anyway, of course, and often sometimes from the symptoms. But while there are still symptoms, there's definitely an attempt by the body to restore coherence. Capitalism has brought about the emancipation of collective humanity with respect to nature, but this collective humanity has itself taken on, with respect to the individual, the oppressive function formerly exercised by nature. I've often thought about this in less specific ways, as in the adversity that we need to develop and grow, that came from nature, that we're now protected from. Now it comes from the same state that protects us. This is true even with material things, fire, water, etc. The community has taken possession of all these natural forces. Question: can this emancipation won by society be transferred to the individual? The notion of oppression is, in short, a stupidity. One only has to read the Iliad, and the notion of an oppressive class is even more stupid. We can only speak of an oppressive structure of society. And whence comes that structure, if not from human mind? We must eliminate affliction as much as we can from social life, for affliction only serves the purpose of grace, and society is not a society of the elect. There will always be enough affliction for the elect. Well, it is interesting because it suggests perhaps that the increased comfort in the world that that reduces physical affliction for most people, I'd say, maybe, or certainly a lot in the Western world, seems to go hand in hand with an encroaching soul affliction, soullessness, alienation, isolation, soul jeopardy. It seems to put that in a more positive or a benign context, which I would. It's like I always seem to be arguing for, things are way worse than you realize, and even the things you think are better aren't better because they're actually the cause of a much worse problem. They're allowing for something much worse to unfold or develop. That's the argument I'm generally making, but that's because people are still in this position, many of them, of misperceiving, I would say, social changes as progress and as an improvement outside the context of the deeper unconscious accumulation of unprocessed trauma. They're not recognizing that. But if they were to recognize that, or insofar as we can agree on that, then all of this is in a positive context. In fact, not that progress is progress, or that social progress really means anything in its own context, but within the larger context, of reaching the full and final depletion of the will to power, the exhaustion of that engine of survival that is not love, then that's a good thing. Just as if the Earth's resources were to be exhausted, then I'd say that would be a good thing also. As in, you know, for the industry to continue. So yeah, it's good to reach the end of our tether, and this is where I've been at for the last 10 years or so, maybe a bit less, I'd say post-JDR. Is nearer and nearer to experiencing myself at the end of my tether and the exhaustion of my will to power, my spiritual drive to attain, which doesn't mean I'm not still yearning and striving and experiencing acutely the distance between my mind and my soul and my body. But on the one hand, feeling more and more despairing of ever being able to do anything about it, because it becomes less and less comprehensible to me, the situation I'm in. And on the other hand, becoming more and more reconciled to it and at peace with it, the situation, and therefore experiencing the distance less as well as more, strangely. Experiencing the distance as something other than simply distance, because there is no distance between God and us. The distance is between us and God. It's a one-sided divide. And only one side can win, the other side, the side that exists. It's a one-sided divide because there is no divide. The sound of one hand jacking. To contemplate the social is as good a way of detachment as to retire from the world. That is why I have not been wrong to rub shoulders with politics for so long. Yeah, I second that. Right, so we're near the end. Oh, there's a few more passages. The meaning of Plato's politics is that power should be in the hands of a social group composed of conquerors and conquered. But that is against nature, except when the conquerors are barbarian. From this point of view, the victory of barbarians over civilized peoples, when it is not destructive, is more fruitful than that of civilized peoples over barbarians. Yes, well, technical development, which puts force and civilization on the same side, makes such regenerations impossible. It is accursed. Basically saying force needs to be in the hand of the uncivilized and the barbarians. And I suspect that there's some truth in this, even though certainly not the optimal situation, of course. But I think that those who rule us in secret or not have barbaric practices, definitely in secret. The supreme atheistic idea is the idea of progress, which is the negation of experimental ontological proof, for it implies that the mediocre can of itself produce the best. But all modern science combines in rejecting the idea of progress. Darwin destroyed the illusion of internal progress which was found in Lamarck. The theory of mutations only leaves chance and elimination as valid. The theory of energetics postulates that energy deteriorates and never increases, and this is applicable even to vegetable and animal life. A future which is completely impossible, like the ideal of the Spanish anarchists, degrades us far less and differs far less from the eternal than a possible future. It does not even degrade us at all, except through the illusion of its possibility. If it is conceived of as impossible, it transports us into the eternal. The possible is the realm of the imagination, and thus of degradation. We must wish either for that which actually exists, or for that which cannot in any way exist, or still better, for both. That which is and that which cannot be are both outside the realm of becoming. I think that could be misapplied because there's a lot of people wishing for what is impossible, but technology is giving the illusion that it is possible. So I don't think that's what she's talking about. It has to be a full recognition that it's impossible, and so therefore no attempt to bring it about. I can't imagine what that would be, really, except union with God, which we can recognize I can as impossible, and yet I can desire it with all my heart and soul. We are attached to the present. We manufacture the future in our imagination. Only the past, when we do not remanufacture it, is pure reality. Time, as it flows, wears down and destroys that which is temporal. Accordingly, there is more of eternity in the past than in the present. The value of history, properly understood, is analogous to that of remembrance in Proust. Thus the past presents us with something which is at the same time real and better than ourselves, something which can draw us upward, a thing the future never does. What that made me think of was how much I've liked listening to audios that I've made in the past. Not podcasts, I don't listen to them back, but my own private audios to myself. And how the experience of it, the main thing I think that makes it so pleasing to me is that I see my past that I'm captured and reliving by listening to it as somehow perfect, like a fly in amber, as preserved in perfection. Not that my memory of it is perfect, but that that time everything seems perfect now, even though mostly it was a time of suffering and discontentment, dissatisfaction, despair, anger, and all of the things that I continue to suffer, but more so back then, if anything. So it's certainly not a wistful nostalgia for a better time. On the contrary, in fact, I particularly enjoy listening to the bad times. It's not too bad, because then I'm incoherent, but... And I never really have understood it until I read that by Simone Weil, that because it's past, it has this empirical reality. It seems no longer subjective. It's not subject to the imagination. It's not subject to the will. It's not subject to desire. It simply is what happened. And yet it seems to be present too. And so, of course, the act of listening is bringing the past into the present. So there's something, I suppose it's similar to the joy that we can experience watching a good movie or a TV show, it's engagement with life without any of the burden of having to apply the will or somehow influence it or be influenced by it. Somehow that's illusory, is what she's suggesting, because we're in this confused state where we don't recognize that everything is happening or unfolding in an eternal context, therefore it's not happening in time, and therefore it's never happened, and it never can happen, and that's, I mean, it's easier to have that sense in the of something in the past, I suppose, or certainly a movie, we know that never really happened, but we enjoy entering into the illusion of something that is really happening. And so I think that this is somehow central to embodiment, that when we become fully landed in the present moment, we are no longer trapped by time. So we're no longer on this linear drive towards some imagined future, fleeing some forgotten past and trying to manage the present always to direct it towards the imagined end. And all of that engagement, the hammer surrounded by nails, bang 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 all day long, simply, not only is it a stressful existence, but because it's so stressful, it's not true existence. It doesn't allow us to perceive existence as it is. Whereas when we look at the past, there's no more stress about the past. Some things we've got engrams about, but and so we can just perceive it as it is, which is as it was. Ah, boy, I'm awfully tired and I'm thirsty, and I'm hot as well, because it's very hot here. A couple more pages, so I'll wind up. The constant illusion of revolution consists in believing that the victims of force, being innocent of the outrages that are committed, will use force justly if it is put into their hands. But except for souls which are fairly near to saintliness, the victims are defiled by force just as their tormentors are. The evil which is in the handle of the sword is transmitted to its point. So the victims thus put in power and intoxicated by the change do as much harm or more, and soon sink back again to where they were before. Socialism consists in imputing good to the conquered, and racialism in imputing good to the conquerors. But the revolutionary wing of socialism makes use of those who, though lowly born, are by nature and by vocation conquerors. Thus it ends up by having the same form of ethics. Humanity deteriorates at each swing of the pendulum. How far will this go? After the collapse of our civilization, there must be one of two things. Either the whole of it will perish like the ancient civilizations, or it will adapt itself to a decentralized world. It rests with us not to break up the centralization, for it automatically goes on increasing like a snowball until the catastrophe comes, but to prepare for the future. Our period has destroyed the interior hierarchy. How should it allow the social hierarchy, which is only a clumsy image of it, to go on existing? You could not be born at a better period than the present, when we have lost everything. The spirituality of work. Work makes us experience in the most exhausting manner the phenomenon of finality rebounding like a ball. To work in order to eat in order to work. A squirrel turning in its cage and the rotation of the celestial sphere, extreme misery and extreme grandeur. It is when man sees himself as a squirrel turning round and round in a circular cage that, if he does not lie to himself, he is close to salvation. No poetry concerning the people is authentic if fatigue does not figure in it, and the hunger and thirst which come from fatigue. Well, that's a good point to end on. Because fatigue, my God, be it ever so chronic. I've never been so chronically fatigued as lately, but it's not the suffering of chronic fatigue in the past, and it's fatigue from work, essentially. So it's a virtuous fatigue. I put virtuous in ironic air quotes because it's a very mundane and profane virtue, that of simply working a day job and doing stuff and activity that I just enjoy doing. It's a combination of necessity and enjoyment, but somehow more and more compelled to work harder and be more engaged in the world, and more exhausted as a result of it. But I do think that the exhaustion is necessary as a way to wear down my defences, to allow something to get through them and get past them. Not a Trojan horse, but an angelic messenger, if you will, that I would simply not open the door to if I wasn't too exhausted to think before I react. There's something in us, I think, that can only respond when our reactions are dulled and slowed and depleted to the extent that we're kind of inert. So we're reacting less and less, not necessarily doing less and less, because I say I'm busier and busier, if anything, but kind of more and more impartial or indifferent to stuff because of this exhaustion. And so it leaves more and more space for a response to happen in, because more and more times I'm not reacting or responding. But also I'm not reacting and responding, and I'm responding because there's no reaction. So like, if I don't react, but also if I don't push a response, if I don't drag up a response or contrive a response because I feel like I should respond, then likewise there's a possibility of an authentic response. And I think that that's all that we have. It's all I have for today anyway, is to end on an authentic response. Yes, hopefully this wasn't too rushed and disconnected because of it. An hour and 20 minutes. So okay, so this is The Liminalist, the podcast between. I'm very tired, I'm very hot, very fuzzy, need to drink some water. Going on a trip as of Saturday, which will be in the past by the time anyone hears this. Going to be in England, Finland, and if and when, God willing, I get back, I will probably put together the God's Lonely People. That was a bit slurpy. God's Lonely People workshop, for lack of a better word, if it's a workshop or what it is, but a project. Also consultations, as you'll see at my website, I'm going to be available for consultation one-to-ones as of September. There will be on a sliding scale, and the first consultation will be free of charge. As far as what I'll be consulting you on, that would be up to you, and what the context for it would be. Well, I think if you've listened to this podcast, you pretty much know what my approach is in dialogue. So it would be essentially be me listening and responding to you with an aim or an intent to provide some degree of guidance based on mirroring your experience with my own, essentially. So applying my experience in being liminal and allowing for authentic responses in an afflicting existence such as it is in this world that we live in a way that would be useful to you. Could be useful to you. Okay, and if you would like to do that, just send me an email, jason@protonmail.com. If you'd like to support this podcast, do that also. That is at horticulture.com/liminalist. Till next time, signing off, disappearing, going, going, gone.